Several years ago, a survey was taken about a most American subject, that of freedom. People across the United States were asked to name those who they thought to be most free in this country. So this morning, I'm curious, who do you think most Americans thought were the most free people in this country? Who?
Single people.
Hold that thought. Others?
The wealthy.
Retirees.
Debt-free.
Debt-free.
Children.
All right. Well, the answer is closer than you may believe, geographically, that is, because the people who were identified as most free in this survey were college students. And a professor would disagree with that. But not just any college students, Professor Ackland, but college students who belonged to a fraternity. Now, like any decent survey, if fraternity brothers were ranked first as the most free in our society, then someone had to be ranked last. So again, I ask you, who do you think most Americans thought were the least free in this country?
Mothers.
Context is everything.
Fraternity members' parents.
Fraternity members' parents. Right. Clergy. Suzanne.
Undocumented
residents here in the States. Yes. The disabled. Prisoners. Mm-hmm. Well, in this survey, it was monks. People, and specifically for these responders, men, who took vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Now, what I love about this survey is that I first heard about it from a monk. And this same monk said that for him, it is actually in his vocation, within the context of these vows, that he feels most free. For many, this sense of freedom to act while being bound by vows is a paradox. Two apparently opposite beliefs laying alongside one another. And this seeming contradiction is exactly what we encounter in our gospel from John today. This morning we picked up where we left off last week. We are still in what is known as the final discourse of Jesus in John's gospel. And in it, Jesus is telling the disciples what he expects life will be like after he dies. And it is here that we butt up against another one of those paradoxes of the Christian faith, the command to love. Because in this passage, Jesus very clearly commands the disciples, and by the nature of our connection, generation after generation after generation, he commands us. Now, commandments often bring with them feelings of duty, of obligation, and inevitably, of guilt. And yet, when Jesus talks about commandments in this passage, it is always clarified by being a commandment to love. A commandment to love. A command to engage in an action that, by its very definition, must be self-giving. How does that work? Well, again, this week it is critical to know what kind of love we speak. The kind of love being described here is the same kind of love that our associate rector, Kristen Krantz, preached about last week. In this passage, the word in Greek that is used when we hear the English word love is once again the word agape. And it is the kind of love that is primarily interested in the good of the other person. Let's just say that today you are going to buy flowers for a woman whom you love. When you present that beautiful bouquet to said woman, after she has said how wonderful they are, you are unlikely to say the following things. Oh, well, I just happened to be driving by Target and they were on sale, so I figured you appreciate a deal, right? Or, well, I knew you'd be pretty angry if I didn't buy you flowers. So here they are. No, this kind of love, this agape, has nothing to do with guilt or with duty. It is a kind of love that only exists in mutuality. It is reflexive by nature. It can be hard to find, and it is nearly impossible to put into words. I believe this is why Jesus changes his language at this point in his final night with the disciples. Now, here I tread on ground with tremendous caution because, much like the word love, the word friend is fraught with semantic peril. For friend is another word and concept that seems to have been stripped of all of its meaning, and this was well before Facebook was preparing its IPO. Like the concept of love, friendship has been slowly but surely sentimentalized so that it can mean just about anything and then really nothing at all. And yet, I believe that deep and abiding friendship shows us the way to bridge our paradox of being commanded to love. For centuries, the great theologians of the church have written about it. Thomas Aquinas said that the goal of the Christian life was to be friends, friends with God, echoing the words of Gregory of Nyssa, who 1,000 years earlier than Aquinas wrote that the only thing worthwhile in life was to be God's friend. For the Christian, the true nature of this kind of friendship is found in the mutuality of giving and of receiving. It is grounded in equality, an equality that shows the difference between servant and friend. It is a way of being for and with another. It is an essential glimpse into the life of the Trinity. But as one might expect, Jesus' understanding of friendship isn't all peaches and cream. For in this passage, Jesus shows us what it is like to live into this commandment to love. Verses 12 and 13 of John 15. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. No one has greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. This actually is our bridge, our way to stand astride the paradox. For friendship, true and abiding friendship, involves all of one's attention being given to another. When we hear Jesus' words about laying down his life offered On the last night before his crucifixion, we cannot but hear them as dying for another. And this can be true. The recent murder, really the martyrdom, for martyr means witness, of an Episcopal priest and a parish administrator in Maryland are but one instance of this kind of self-giving action. But I would offer today, friends, what I would offer is that to lay down our lives as the Good Shepherd does carries more meaning than physical death. To lay down one's life as a friend is to offer compassion, literally to suffer with another. It is sacrificial in the fullest sense, the giving of something of value to receive something of even greater value. It is mutual, it is self-giving. Again, not coming from a place of obligation, but from a well of love that has already been received, from a love that precedes our own. It is being present totally and completely. One can be trained to do this, as our Stephen ministers have been. But at its core, this kind of friendship is witnessed when one acts with agape, with the kind of love invested in another. Parker Palmer, the remarkable Quaker theologian and author, has shared the story of his depression and of how others responded to him in that time of darkness. But rather than paraphrasing his words, I would like to offer them as he shared them when he was interviewed by Krista Tippett, the host of the show Speaking of Faith. Here is Palmer's story. I had folks coming to me, of course, who wanted to be helpful, and sadly, many of them weren't. These were the people who would say, "Gosh, Parker, why are you sitting in here being depressed? It's a beautiful day outside. Go, you know, feel the sunshine and smell the flowers." And that, of course, leaves a depressed person even more depressed. Because while you intellectually know that it's sunny out and that the flowers are lovely and fragrant, you can't really feel any of that in your body, which is dead in a sensory way. And so you're left more depressed by this, quote, good advice to get out and enjoy the day. And then other people would come and say something along the lines of, "Gosh, Parker, why are you depressed? You're such a good person. You've helped so many people. You've written so well." And that would leave me feeling more depressed because I would feel I've just defrauded another person who, if they really knew what a schmuck I was, would cast me into the darkness where I already am. There was this one friend who came to me after asking permission to do so. Every afternoon, about 4 o'clock, he sat me down in a chair in the living room, took off my shoes and socks, and massaged my feet. He hardly ever said anything. He was a Quaker elder. And yet, out of his intuitive sense, from time to time, he would say a very brief word like, "I can feel your struggle today." Or farther down the road, "I feel that you're a little stronger at this moment, and I'm glad for that." But beyond that, he would hardly say anything. He would give no advice. He would simply report from time to time what he was sort of intuiting about my condition. Somehow he found the one place in my body, namely the soles of my feet, where I could experience some sort of connection to another human being. And the act of massaging, just, you know, in a way I don't really have words for, kept me connected with the human race. What he mainly did for me, of course, was to be willing to be present to me in my suffering. He just hung in with me in this very quiet, very simple, very tactile way. And I've never been able to find the words to fully express my gratitude for that, but I know it made a huge difference. And it became for me a metaphor of the kind of community we need to extend to people who are suffering in this way, which is a community that is neither invasive of the mystery nor evasive of the suffering, but is willing to hold people in a space, a sacred space of relationship, where somehow this person who is on the dark side of the moon can get a little confidence that they can come around to the other side.